Hello and welcome back to Celluloid Jelly, a podcast featuring a couple of ex-video store guys who just love talking about movies. I'm CJ Talbot, and joining me as always is Cesar Alejandro Jr. from Filmsmash.com. For this episode, we're discussing 1999's October Sky, directed by Joe Johnston.
Episode 26.
Yeah, the last one was a mountain, wasn't it, guys?
I had to listen to it like three times as I was like putting the thing together, so it was...
Lucky you, what a treat for your ears.
It really was, though. I had the most fun doing that episode. That was great. Like, it was a little, maybe a little too long, so our listeners, I guess, will let us know about that. But, for the most part, I had a great time, and I hope we start mixing it up a bit more and doing sort of like top five this, or, you know what I really want to do is sort of like pit like two movies against each other in a death match to see, you know, like who's better. I know a lot of other, like, you know, movie shows and podcasts and stuff do that, you know, as their theme. But, like, you know, I'd really like to sort of like debate Godfather versus Godfather 2 or Alien versus Aliens or something like that.
You know, The Substitute versus Kindergarten Cop.
Well, Kindergarten Cop wins every fucking time.
And Tom Berenger's pretty tough.
He is, and so is Treat Williams in the sequels, but you can't go wrong with those kids. It might be a tumor.
Yeah, that's exactly how they say it.
That was your cue to say, it's not a tumor.
I don't trust my impersonation. AC was here, though.
Yeah, AC does a pretty good Jeff Goldblum.
He does a pretty good, it's not a tumor.
It's not a tumor. He does it better. You got me doing Arnold Schwarzenegger in the last episode when we were talking about Commando.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's an American classic, I think.
It really is the high point of, like, 1980s, like, muscle man action movies.
Was that a movie that you even considered for your 25?
No, but I love that movie, though. Commando, and then probably, like, for Stallone, Rambo First Blood Part 2.
Yeah, I really loved Rambo when I was a kid. I used to have toys, because there was a cartoon, too.
Written by Jim Cameron, right? The First Blood Part 2 was a script that Cameron wrote, I think.
You know, I don't remember. I haven't watched Rambo in a while, so.
I'm going to Google it.
You going to Google it?
When you say googly, all I can think of is you doing John Voight saying ding-a-ling.
For everyone to see. Thinking about John Voight because what movie are you watching? What are we talking about this week? Thinking about John Voight because of that?
I think we watched two different movies, right? What were we supposed to watch this week?
October Sky.
Because I watched every Harry Potter movie.
Oh, yeah. I noticed. Yeah. I guess, you know, it'd be a good companion piece for October Sky, the film Zoolander.
Absolutely.
You hear some themes?
They do. I'm sure we'll talk about them.
October Sky was a big influence on Derek Zoolander.
And yes, Jim Cameron did write Rambo First Blood Part 2, so bam.
It was good stuff, Jim. That guy's going to make it.
Troutman, he's got the greatest lines. Rambo hardly says anything.
He does have that scene where he's in the mud and he opens his eyes. That seems pretty cool.
All right, let's get on track.
Says so much with those two open eyes.
We probably need to start over. Welcome back, everybody. Here we go.
Hey, guys.
How are you, Cesar?
I'm doing all right, CJ. How are you?
I'm doing well. What have you seen that you want to recommend to the kids at home?
Oh man, you know what? I really have been taking a bit of a hiatus on watching movies. I don't know if you've noticed.
I haven't.
I tried to make a concerted effort to go through and read more of my graphic novels that have been piling up, so I did that.
Cool.
In terms of like stuff I've watched, I guess I watched what came out theatrically last week? I don't recall.
Rampage?
No, that's this week, isn't it?
No, that's out. It was.
Is it?
Yeah.
I don't remember. Okay. Well, I watched. I did end up watching a couple of DVDs I had, but not film. I was watching some of the Super Sentai Gyuranger series on DVD, which is, you know, in the United States, people know them as Power Rangers, but it's the Japanese release version from Shout Factory.
Yeah, expensive DVD box sets.
Yeah, they're a lot of fun. A lot of innocent people get killed in them, way more so than the kids show I remember watching in the United States. But these are really ridiculous and really great and fantastic stuff. There's so much of it. Like, I watched maybe like 10 or 12 episodes. You know, I don't really watch a lot of television.
Yeah, me either.
But yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. So I'll have a better answer next episode.
Are you planning on watching Netflix's Lost in Space? I hear it's pretty good.
Probably not. I don't really have that much affection for the franchise as a whole. Though I feel like I probably watched the entirety of the original series just in syndication on like TNT over the years.
Yeah.
Specifically when I was a kid, I'm pretty sure I definitely watched like a good majority of Lost in Space during a couple summers as a kid. Because if I remember correctly, TNT used to do like 2 hours of it, like midday. And then when Sci-Fi Channel became a thing, I think they kind of moved it over to that. So I remember watching a lot of episodes from them.
Yeah, I remember that Matt LeBlanc movie. That was a killer one, right? Yeah. The
Matt LeBlanc film, yeah.
LeBlanc. Oh, man. Yeah.
I've never seen it. So
William Hurt, Mimi Rogers, Heather Graham, and who was the other daughter?
Gary Oldman.
She was on Party of Five.
Isn't Gary Oldman in that?
Lacey Chabert. Yeah, Gary Oldman played the doctor who ends up being the bad guy.
Oh. Dr. Smith? Is that his name?
Yeah. I think so. It's been a while since I've seen it.
He's the bad guy in that movie?
He's the bad guy. Well, spoiler alert, yeah. I think, if I remember correctly, he turns into like this, like giant alien spider at the end.
What?
It must have been a John Peters production.
That sounds awful. That doesn't sound like anything like the show I remember.
It pretty much is. It's bad. But hey, in any case. We saw Blockers over the weekend. That was pretty good, actually. Like, I was surprised.
That movie just kind of popped up out of nowhere. I didn't see trailers or anything for it ahead of time at all.
Well, we did... Chelsea and I, a few months ago, went to Irvine and saw, oh God, I think it was The Post at the Spectrum 21 in Irvine. And outside the theater, you know, we were rushing in. We were a little bit late, and we were afraid that we were going to miss a lot of the previews. But this guy came up and was like, hey, you can get free movie tickets if you come over here and take a survey. And we were like, well, how long will it take? And he was like, about 10 minutes. And so we gave it a try. And it wasn't like a paper survey. They walked us into like this booth that they had set up. And we watched like an extended preview of two movies. And she got to watch an extended preview of Skyscraper with Dwayne Johnson, which is still not out in theaters yet. And I got to watch an extended preview of Blockers and give feedback on it. So we got, you know, a couple of free movie tickets out of it. But so, I've been, you know, keenly aware of it, having participated in that. What I liked about it was that it was really kind of positive about the teenager characters in the movie, both the boys and the girls, which is something you don't see a lot. Usually the boys are either jackasses or overly reckless, or the girls are, you know, bimbos and floozies or whatever. But they, you know, they really portray the kids in a good light. It's fairly sex positive. It's actually fairly drug positive, which, you know, ethically I'm not going to get into. But you know, they really like because the whole thing is that the parents are overreacting, overprotective, and it comes from a good place because they just want to protect their kids, you know, but they're, what they're doing is wrong by trying to, you know, intervene and stop them from having what is for most kids a normal prom night. So, yeah. So, you know, I thought it was well done. You know, I had some good laughs. It's super dumb, of course, but in a good way. Like, I thought it was fairly satisfying, you know, for what it is. So John Cena is very funny. Leslie Mann is the female lead as one of the parents. And then Ike Barnholtz is the third parent. It's funny because, like, John Cena and Leslie Mann are the more likable parents, but they're the ones that are more in the wrong. Like, Ike Barnholtz is sort of like a, I don't know, he's portrayed as being sort of like the dim-witted, like, loser character, but he's doing it from a much more positive place. I don't want to spoil anything, but, like, what, the reason he's hooked up with them is so that his daughter does not make a mistake or get pressured into doing something that she's not, I don't know. It's hard to describe without telling you what it is, but, like, yeah, so, quick spoiler alert, she's gay, and she makes a sex pact to have sex with her prom date, who is a boy, and her father does not want her to make that mistake because he knows that she's gay, even though she hasn't come out yet. It gets, in a couple of scenes, it gets a little emotional and a little tender, but it never loses that sort of, like, outrageous quality. So it's pretty good. You know, give it a shot. It's CJ recommended.
I still want to watch Rampage, and I guess it's all about Avengers pretty soon, so we'll see what's up.
You got tickets for the Senator?
I did, yep.
Cool. I don't know what we're doing. I'm sure we'll probably see it somewhere local here, but because we didn't see Star Wars at the Cinerama Dome, I think we're going to see Avengers at the Cinerama Dome.
Did you get tickets already? Not yet?
No. Buy tickets early. We don't need to do that. That's crazy.
All right. Well, I guess you don't have a senator over there, though. So.
No. Well, there's only one senator, and I miss it dearly.
Well, I'll be sure to send you a picture of that bitch.
Yeah, thank you for the picture you sent me when you were in D.C. That was lovely. I appreciate that.
No problem. I think you're the only one who got that and actually posted it anywhere else. I told you I was going to send you one, so.
I didn't share it with anyone.
You can treasure it.
I am treasuring it right now.
All right. Why are we here? Yeah, I guess we had a bit of a discussion.
Yeah, this was your pick, so why don't you introduce the movie we're going to be talking about?
Okay, everyone. This movie is a film from 1999. It's Joe Johnston's October Sky, based on Homer Hickam's Rocket Boys. Semi-autobiography. It's a terrific film. I'm a big fan of it. I know CJ was a big fan, but it's been a while since I've seen it, so I'm quite looking forward to checking it out, to discussing it with CJ.
I was going to say, we're not going to watch it, right? You already watched it.
I don't think we've had, like, we talked about it briefly, but I don't know that we've ever had, like, a real discussion about this film ever, so.
For a second there, I thought you threw me for a loop and that this was going to be a commentary track.
Oh, yeah?
I'm looking forward to watching it.
Primed? Okay, and press play.
All right, Universal logo is coming up now.
Oh, wait, I'm playing Scott Pilgrim. Sorry.
We could talk about that one.
Later.
That would make our buddy Chris very happy.
Yeah, I'm sure it would.
He recommended that. Do you remember?
Yeah, but we already did Hot Fuzz. Yeah, I talked to him on Sunday. And I was like, yeah, I like Scott Pilgrim a lot. Hot Fuzz is my favorite Edgar Wright film, though.
Yeah.
And, like, his jaw dropped to the floor.
Hot Fuzz is obviously Edgar Wright's best movie.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah, there's no question. Although I do love Scott Pilgrim. And I like Shaun of the Dead a lot. I like The World's End a lot. He hasn't really let me down, you know. Baby Driver, I think, is maybe my least favorite of his films, but it was still pretty good.
Yeah. Okay. So, do you want to say what the film October Sky is about? I said it was based on a book, but
sure. Let's see. It is about a young man, Homer Hickam, played by Jake Gyllenhaal, who is brought up in a coal mining town in West Virginia, and you know, in that type of an environment, it is sort of just expected that these kids will follow in their parents' footsteps and work in the mine. Homer has other ideas. After being, or after the launch of Sputnik, his imagination runs wild about getting into rocketry and wanting to become an astronaut. And so he sets himself off on a different path, which creates tension within his family, but also allows the town to sort of rally around him and these young kids who are the Rocket Boys, his friends that help him do this. And it's a, you know, pretty heartwarming story. And we're going to talk about it a little bit more in depth. But that's pretty much it.
Okay. So when was the last time you had seen this film, CJ?
Well, curiously enough, before you picked this as our next episode, I introduced Chelsea to this a few weeks ago.
Did you watch it with her?
Yeah, yeah, she enjoyed it. Yeah, it was 2 to 3 weeks ago, before we recorded our 25th episode.
Oh, okay.
So
I saw that she had watched it, but I didn't. I guess you had watched something else that superseded like your Letterboxd photograph. So
maybe, yeah, all those Harry Potter movies. All those damn Harry Potter movies.
Damn it.
So, but yeah, she enjoyed it. And of course, you know, I really look at October Sky as sort of like cinematic comfort food. You know, we're going to talk a little bit more, you know, about this throughout the episode, but this is just one of those movies that has a nice story, you know, that I mean, when you picked it as the subject of our episode, I was a little worried because I wasn't sure if we could fill up an hour talking about October Sky, because it's just a really solid movie. It's got good performances, but there's nothing that really like stands out about it. You know, and Joe Johnston, you know, is a filmmaker that I think doesn't have an incredibly strong authorial stamp visually. You know, he's a very workman-like director, I think. He's a strong, you know, capable director. You know, he's certainly made quite a few good movies on his resume, with Captain America and The Rocketeer. This one, I'm not a fan of it, but I know a lot of people really love Jumanji. So, you know, but you know, this film is just, I don't know, it's spaghetti and meatballs. You know, I just, you know, I can watch it anytime. And I really enjoy it. But, like, I'm not sure there's a whole lot of interesting stuff cinematically going on. But it's a beautiful story. And, I, you know, I'm a sucker for a good true story. So I think maybe that's part of the reason why I really like this movie.
Mm-hmm.
How did you first come to this movie?
To be honest, I guess I saw it on DVD probably... I think I did a blind buy for it at Suncoast, but it was before you were my manager.
Okay, so it wasn't specifically on a recommendation from me.
No, it was a during the Jeff Pelikakis days.
Ooh.
Yeah, so I guess like...
Hi, Jeff.
I want to say I probably spent like $25 to $30 on that DVD back then.
Universal had heavy price points in the beginning.
Yeah.
They did. Like, I remember $34.98 price points on a lot of their movies.
Yeah, but they saved you a penny with that 98, though.
They sure did. Thanks, Universal. You're the best.
So, I mean, you know, for, I guess back then, I didn't really have stuff like bills, so it was easy for me to drop stuff like that on things unseen without doing research. But, you know, it's the type of film that I particularly, you mentioned comfort food, but it's the type of film that I particularly really, really enjoy. I think there's a rewatchability to it that that kind of makes the film higher in regard for me in subsequent viewings. But you're right, I think that the film itself doesn't necessarily have much to offer new cinematically, I think sometimes, you mentioned the heartwarming nature of the film, sometimes being able to elicit an emotion out of the audience, even after having seen it, you know, a half dozen times like I have, you know, it's pretty admirable. So I think there's something special about this movie, that I just can't quite articulate, but I can feel it, like, when I watch it, especially, like, at the end of the film.
Yeah, I like that. I like where your thoughts are going here, because, like, as you're saying that, what I keep thinking about is that this story is, it's universal, but it's decidedly American in a way. You know, the idea of... you know, I mean, it's a Cold War story. You know, the Russians launch a satellite, and then America wants to battle back and launch a satellite and put a man into space, and it captures the imaginations of these young kids. You know, and it's not a. I mean, this is based on a true story, but you know, there's no better encapsulation of like America in this time period than a coal mining town in West Virginia. You know, there's a line, let me see if I'm not sure I'm going to get it right. There's a line somewhere in the middle of the movie when Homer's arguing with his father, who's played by Chris Cooper, and his father says something to the effect of, the coal we're mining makes steel, and if steel fails, this country fails. And that's kind of like, that encapsulates like his father's attitude, and, you know, and it also encapsulates kind of like, like, this movie is about moving past that and moving on to greater things. That sort of moving from the post-World War II America and that industrial age to the more inspirational Kennedy-esque America of the 60s, where we're sort of looking into bigger things than we ever thought we could accomplish, like putting a man on the moon.
There's a feeling of hope that, like, this film has, especially considering... the film is from 1999, but you know, we watch, you know, it's almost 20 years old at this point. It's hard to believe. But one of the big things that's changed in America since this film was made has been the dismantling of the space program in the United States.
Yeah.
Now, this subsequent viewing that we did to this for discussion for this episode, one of the things that was kind of prevailing for me is how much hope that this film kind of instills. There's, like you mentioned, that there's like a, you know, Jake Gyllenhaal's character Homer, he's quite a bit of a dreamer. And you know, eventually, of course, that's what gets him and like the Rocket Boys out of this, you know, I guess, this circle of expectation, like that they're trapped in this town. It's what leads them to break through and become, you know, something beyond that of a coal miner.
Right.
But with the dismantling of the space program, you know, one of the things that was always in the back, that was back in my head during this viewing is that, like, how we don't really have that kind of hopefulness these days. And it could just be sign of the times. But yeah, I think there's a much more prevailing feeling of not necessarily exploration, but of, you know, looking internally. Which, you know, I think that's kind of unfortunate, you know.
I think, you know, when it comes to this kind of stuff, I'm not incredibly well-informed. I'm not the smartest guy in geopolitics or anything like that. But I think our worldwide economy, you know, can't support the type of exploration that we want to do with all the other things that we use money for. So, like, you know, I mean,
that's a good diplomatic way of putting it.
I mean, you know, we went to the moon, you know, we kind of, you know, we brought home a bunch of rocks. We looked at it, you know, we sent some probes to Mars. People want to go to Mars, but I guess for a lot of people, they're like, well, we didn't find anything on the moon. So why the hell should we go to Mars? And if we go to Mars, it's going to take a lot longer to get there. It's going to take a lot more money to make it happen. And I think a lot of people, you know, we look at everything like a business now, no matter what it is. You know, even like the education system, the healthcare system, things that shouldn't be looked at as businesses are looked at specifically as business, big business. And the space program became no different. And at this point, there's no profit in going there, I think, is the biggest thing.
Sure.
So again, you know, like that's, you know, please tweet at me if I'm wrong. If anyone out there has more insight into, you know, what's going on with privatized space programs, you know, like what Tesla's doing or whatever, you know, let us know. But I, you know, I don't know. I don't know if NASA's finished, but I don't see us putting trillions of dollars into going to a different planet anymore. The way I think we would have 20 years ago.
Sure. There's our mutual friend AC. Yep. He and I and another friend, we went down to Washington D.C. just last week to see the cherry blossoms while they were in bloom. While we were there, of course, we hit a handful of Smithsonian museums, including the Air and Space Museum. And,
love that.
You know, it's the best museum that the Smithsonian has, and I've been to all of them except for the African American History Museum because it's still hard to get in.
Yeah, didn't you go to the Spy Museum last year?
Yeah, that's not Smithsonian. Well, not last year, a couple years ago. But that's not a Smithsonian museum.
DC, I went to the Newseum, which was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's to a different location than where it used to be. So
really?
I'm not sure. Yeah, it's like on Pennsylvania Avenue now.
It was on Pennsylvania Avenue before, I think, when I was
there.
It's
moved recently, so I'm pretty sure. Well, recently as in like the last 5 years, so you may have seen it while it was at its new location. But it moved to like a bigger spot, if I remember correctly.
Okay. Well, it was really cool. I'm glad I went. And we went to, was it Constitution Hall, where they have like the Declaration of Independence and stuff sitting out?
I don't know.
Man, for being from Baltimore, I don't know shit about anything.
Well, anyway, you know, our friend AC, he flies satellites for at Goddard. And while we were wandering around the Air and Space Museum, like, him being in that field, there's a walking through that that museum, there was an animated light to him.
Yeah.
That I really, really enjoy. Just, you know, I wouldn't say it was quite like a kid looking at like a dinosaur skeleton or anything for the first time, because, you know, AC's he's an adult and very informed. But like, I could tell that he was very passionate about aerospace.
Oh yeah.
And one thing I thought was really cool is that, we went to an area that was talking about, new, or current satellites that were flying. And there was a display for the satellite that he controls. So I remember thinking that was pretty cool.
Oh, wow. That is awesome.
So, yeah, I took a picture of him next to, like, the display. It was called Terra, the satellite Terra. So
I miss AC.
He's a good guy.
He is. It's been way too long.
Yeah, like, I think that, like, the feeling that I had watching AC being enthusiastic about, like, exploration and the unknown and stuff is something that really was in the back of my mind watching this film. And I really like that sense of wonder and unexplained. Typically, not just in, you know, terms of space or exploration, but just in general fantasy or what have you. But I think this movie is able to kind of capture a lot of that. And I think it's satisfying watching people realize it too, you know?
Yeah.
I think for me, that's probably one of the more prevailing like themes of the movie. Maybe not the most, but yeah, I do miss that slice of Americana.
Yeah, you know, and obviously, you know, we talked about Joe Johnston with The Rocketeer and Captain America, and this movie, it is clear that he has sort of an affinity for that period of America as well. I don't mean this in a bad way, but the simplicity of life and the simplicity of ethics, you know, the black and whiteness of it, you know, I mentioned that I didn't think that there were like a ton of great cinematic things in this movie, but as I'm thinking, there are a couple of things that he does, you know, as far as just visually telling the story and bringing in some visual motifs to the story that I think are nice touches. And I think, you know, I don't know if it's a personal preference on his part, you know, but I think maybe the reason he doesn't do a lot of cinematic flourishes is because, you know, he obviously, you know, he's making an old fashioned type of movie. But he does do some interesting things. And I think, you know, obviously, when we open the movie, the first sound that you hear is the October 4th, 1957 radio broadcast that confirms that Sputnik has been launched.
Yep.
And I, if I'm not mistaken, I think that's over the Universal logo, and it just continues further into the opening of the movie. When he shows those first shots of the mine, because I think the first shot you see, the title card, is the coiled cable of the elevator, right?
I don't recall.
I'm pretty sure. Like, so I think, like...
Well, like, the one scene that definitely sticks out is the old coal miner with, like, you know, looking up at the sun, or, like, yeah, daylight, and going down. That's the one thing I remember. I recall specifically what part of the elevator you're seeing, though.
Yeah, it's just a nice juxtaposition, I think, because you've got the radio broadcast talking about the great beyond space and satellites, and then you've got... Our first shot is also something mechanical, and it's something that takes you in the opposite direction. It's something that takes you into a more terrestrial, you know, place. So I like that about it. Like, I think that's a nice little touch.
They also use it as a callback too. When Jake Gyllenhaal, when Homer decides that, you know, for the good of his family, he'll start working in the mine, because they recreate that scene with him as he's going down the elevator shaft for the first time. He sees Sputnik through, like, kind of like the caged enclosure, the ceiling of the elevator.
Right, and in contrast, instead of the old man, it is him, but we still are reminded of that, of what he will become if he stays there. So there's a lot of, like, really nice little, like, visual touches that don't necessarily stick out unless you're really trying to analyze and think about them. Like, what I think one of the things that I noticed on this thing, this viewing, was that anytime he was showing the workers in Coalwood at the mine, they're only ever walking one direction in unison together. And the camera always moves with them. So, like...
You see him like a salmon swimming opposite direction.
Yeah, well, it really added, I thought, a motif of, like, uniformity, and sort of, like, informing us of the type of life and the conformity that's expected of Homer and his friends. In a way, like, you know, I've never made the connection between these two films previously, but I think the last time we were watching it, I kept thinking about The Shawshank Redemption a lot. And the way, like, the miners, the way they move, even in the background, reminded me of prison inmates. And they're all dressed in blue, like they are in Shawshank, which is, I think, one of the reasons why. But you had mentioned before that these kids were sort of trapped in this town, that this town was like a prison for them. And I think that that's obviously something intentional on Johnson's part. So that's just another, like, beautiful, you know, visual motif that he brings to that film. And, you know, I kind of feel like I did him a disservice by saying, you know, there's no cinematic flourishes and this isn't a, you know, great cinematic movie, you know, because you can, it's an incredibly well thought out and well constructed movie, which is why it's so satisfying. So I don't want to take anything away from it by, you know, by saying that he doesn't have the flourish of a David Fincher or Paul Thomas Anderson, you know. Not everybody can be those guys, but what he's doing is almost on a subliminal level, really speaking to you as a viewer, I think.
Sure. Yeah. I think, I mean, you mentioned, there weren't really any standout scenes. I mean, or performances, but I really like Chris Cooper in the film.
He's terrific.
Yeah. He's a character that really grows in this film.
Is this the same year as American Beauty? When did American Beauty come out?
98. So this is the year after.
Okay. All right.
In terms of release, you know, so. But this film, well, I guess you mentioned earlier that scene where he and Homer have an argument that ends with Homer.
You mean the one in the kitchen? Because that's the one where they have the best exchange, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I'll leave, and I won't look back.
Right. Yeah.
Get that line.
Yeah, I think Jake Gyllenhaal holds his own. I mean, Chris Cooper at that point was not an incredibly well-known actor. He had been a character actor and a stage actor, and American Beauty is the one that really kind of catapulted him into stardom. But
yeah. I mean, certainly this film, I mean, with being released like just a year later, you know, he was probably working on this film like as
American before Beauty. The Oscar.
Yeah, yeah.
he did win an Oscar for American Beauty, right? Or he was just nominated for supporting.
Yeah, I don't think he won.
Yeah, Spacey won, but yeah. Anyway, but yeah, they have a couple of. I think they're really good together, and I think it's kind of hard to get that father son chemistry on screen, and they definitely do it.
One of the things about this film that I really enjoy. There's you definitely have the underdog. Kind of like a theme playing out in this film, but I think like the byplay of being like a father and son being caught between like, you know, what a father wants for his son and what the son wants for his own legacy, I think is a very interesting dynamic in this film.
Right.
You can see, it's easy to see both of their points, though I definitely recall like the first time watching this feeling that Chris Cooper's character was much harsher. That I remember, though this more recent viewing, maybe age has kind of helped with it. My own personal age has kind of helped with me seeing Chris Cooper's side a little bit more.
Yeah, I think one of the nice things that they do is they make sure that the father character, John Hickam, has a point of view. That he thinks he's doing best for the family and doing best for Homer by getting this, you know, quote unquote, like, full idea out of his head. He doesn't want his kid to be disappointed. You know, he thinks he knows that his son is going to end up in that mine regardless, so he doesn't want him to have, right, you know, he doesn't want him to have the disappointment of having a dream like that and then losing it and sort of, you know, because that can break a person sometimes.
Sure. Mentioned like prison. You always think about stories of people in concentration camps or prison labor camps, and you know, I've heard stories of people believing that without any reason that they were going to be liberated at a point, but when that day comes, they're just broken,
right?
And nothing happens. So,
yeah, I like the idea that. Yeah, obviously Homer goes through this arc where, you know, he thinks the mine is the worst place in the world, and then he sort of, once he gets down there, he sort of understands that it's bad, but it's really not that bad, and it is a way to make a living, and that there are good people down there. And I think he gets a little bit more respect for his father as a result of that.
Yeah, definitely that level of understanding that he gets, but like he also decides not, you know, that this is also, it's also a taste of it, but it's also like a deciding factor to tell him he definitely doesn't want to do this necessarily. So he always felt intellectually that he didn't want to do this, but I mean, being down there, I think that kind of helps cement his decision too a bit.
Sure.
To kind of pursue rocketry.
I think that's the influence of Miss Riley, who we definitely need to talk about Laura Dern in this. It's after the scene that he goes to see her when she's sick, and she, you know, he sort of gets a glimpse of, you know, fatality at that point, I guess. Like, you know, she's in the hospital, she's sick, you know, she's got Hodgkin's disease, you know, nobody knows how long she's gonna live.
When he sees her after winning the competition, or when he sees
her? No, before that. When he's working in the mines and he goes to see her because she's sick, and she apologizes because she kind of, like, turns a cold shoulder to him when he decides to leave high school.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, but they get back together, and she says that she's sorry, and that she just wanted better things for him. And then there's a line, I think she says something like, "And the most disappointing thing was that I think you made those choices for yourself and didn't follow through with them." And again, I'm paraphrasing. And it's that night that he doesn't sleep, that he goes back to work on the trigonometry to find out where that lost rocket went.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So, you know, her influence over him is, you can't be understated. You know, she's sort of like the only major outside influence beside his family that's sort of like, you know, vying for his soul and for his future. And, you know, I think it really portrays, you know, teachers in general in a pretty good light as a result of, you know, her character being so kind and so supportive to him and the Rocket Boys.
Yeah, the scenes where she stands up to, like, their school principal are pretty great, I think.
Absolutely. And, oh, God, what is his name? The guy that plays the principal, Chris Ellis. What a great freaking character actor this guy is. He's been in everything. He's in, like, a bunch of Michael Bay movies. He's in, like, Armageddon and Transformers and a bunch of stuff. but he's, I mean, he's in, you've seen him in 100 movies, right? I mean, he's great.
Sure, yeah.
That's
pretty recognizable.
This movie has a ton of good character actors. Like, the guy who plays Ike, who unfortunately, you know, spoiler alert, unfortunately dies in the mine. But the character actor's name is Ilya Baskin, and he plays, oh God, what's the guy's name?
In the
Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movies.
Yeah, Steve Ditko, Steve referenced that, his name is Ditkovich. Steve Ditko is the artist for Spider-Man.
Yeah, nice. So yeah, he's been in a lot of stuff too, and he's terrific in this. And I like that,
he's in Austin Powers.
Yeah.
Say, the Russians, are you mad?
I think his character is another point that goes back to the strength of Chris Cooper's character and the idea that Homer feels very guilty over the death of Ike. And then his father says, look, this isn't your fault. I gave him the opportunity to come back out of the mine and go back to the machine shop. And he chose to stay down there for the money, you know. And obviously, you know, probably any father would tell their son that, but I think there's a real, like, an underlying fairness. He's strict, and he doesn't understand his son, but, you know, he's not unfair to his son. He's just trying to do what he thinks is best.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that he doesn't understand his son. I think that's one of the things, like, they're unable to communicate.
Yeah.
Or, like, to see each other's points, but once it happens, it's easy, you know, it's kind of like the misunderstandings kind of wash away a bit, especially by the end of the film.
I think they
make attempts multiple times. I think when Homer, I think the first time you see Homer invite his father to watch a rocket, it's the day when, like, a lot of people show up for the first time. But then an accident or something happens. So his father is trying to say, you know, I'll try to make it there. But then an accident comes and his responsibilities to his job.
Yeah. Okay. But I like that Homer calls him out on it, though. If I remember that scene well enough, where Chris Cooper's character actually realizes that Homer's right. You know, that he does make time for Jim that he doesn't make for Homer.
Yeah, he does a thing where... like some physical acting where his eyes kind of widen a bit in realization and he purses his lips, which I think is a pretty good moment. I think, you know, at that point, of course, yeah, he does try to find a time to do it, but you know, I guess the world gets in the way of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's exterior factors. Like you said, they have an accident in the mine at that point. So, but I like that it takes like Chris Cooper so stubborn that it takes everything in the world to get him there at the end of the day, though. It takes his wife, you know, badgering him about it. It takes Homer standing up to him. And it also takes Homer, you know, explaining to him, you know. I really like that scene where he's after the competition, when they win and get their scholarships, you know, where Homer shakes hands with Dr. Von Braun.
Mm-hmm.
And then John brings that up. You know, he says something like, you met your big hero and didn't even know it, you know, congratulations. And Homer has this little speech where he's like, you know, Dr. Von Braun's a great scientist, but he's not my hero. And then he says something like, you know, I can only hope to be, you know, as good a man as you are. And I think that's the real key moment in the movie where the respect is cemented. Like, he earns respect by going in the mine and putting family first. But I think that moment where he says, you know, we don't see eye to eye, but you are still the man I look up to. That's the point where he, as a father, is like, okay, I'm a dick. And my son is a man now. And, you know, I need to support him instead of trying to take him down.
Yeah, I don't know if respect is necessarily the right word. I think, like, I believe that, like, he's always respected his son, even if he didn't understand him. But I kind of see that moment, though, is him. I think Chris Cooper's got, I mean, there's a couple scenes, especially with the introduction of Dr. Von Braun, where he feels kind of threatened by that character, by, like, this person who only exists in a frame and like, letters, you know?
Yeah.
In that moment when he realizes that, like, you know, I mean, for a guy like that who's used to being, like, the, you know, the person that people look up to in the family, in that moment, he's, you know, it's almost like a sense of relief that, like, oh, you know, I was never, ever replaced in my son's eyes. That's what I mostly take from that moment, I think.
Yeah, you might be right there. I could definitely see that.
His feeling of, like, being so different from his son's supposed hero is, you know, I guess that's the point of insecurity for him.
Sure. So,
and, you know, for a guy who's as earnest as his character is, he's definitely well-versed in covering it up, you know?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's this scene in the mine when John comes back after his injury. And he pulls Homer aside and they go, they're looking at something, and he says, all these guys, you know, they do whatever I say. And Homer says something like, that's because you know more than they do. And he's like, you're goddamn right I do. And he takes a real pride in that. And I think that the knowledge he has of the mine is a different kind of, you know, intelligence than what Wernher von Braun represents to Homer. And I think that in a way that maybe he felt like Homer didn't value the type of intelligence that his father had and valued more so, you know, that sort of academic knowledge. So I, you know, I think you're onto something there, good man. I like that the mom's an artist.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, she's not very good. She's an amateur painter, but it kind of gives her a little bit of a dimension. And when they, like, I really like the scene when someone shoots through the window, and they go out and he decides they're not going to do anything about it. But the bullet goes into the wall in the kitchen where her painting is.
Yeah.
And there's
like,
a shot.
I like that her painting is like of a beach or something.
It's Myrtle Beach, which is where they had their honeymoon, right?
That's where she ends up at the end of the.
Yeah, but I think early in the movie they talk about how they had their honeymoon in Myrtle Beach, and then later in the movie when she threatens to leave him. I like that scene a lot because she says, I will leave you, don't think that I won't. And then he says something, you know, he could say, you'll never leave me or something like that. But instead he just says, where would you go? And she says, Myrtle Beach. And he gives a little smile when she leaves the room because he knows that by her saying Myrtle Beach, that the greatest moment in her life was when they got married. So it's like a callback to that, you know, that it means so much to her.
Yeah. And it's also a bit, I mean, because I mean, if it is Myrtle Beach that she's drawing, I don't know why I never realized that.
Maybe it's not, but I, like, that's what I assumed because it does look like a beach.
I never just made that connection. I always thought it was because, you know, when you're in a coal town, you know, you work for the mine. You know, for people who aren't familiar, coal mining towns, basically everyone who was an employee worked for this mining company. The company owned, like, the house,
right?
You know, the general store, everything. It was quite a bit like sharecropping, I guess, you could say. So, like, I just always thought that, you know, for people, you know, like the sons who are expected to follow their fathers, like the wives, you know, you're going to stay in this town the whole time. So she was drawing something sunny, a beach, or what have you, because it's so different from the view that she sees every day.
Yeah, and it's probably the only time she's ever seen the ocean, and it it's connected to that moment, you know, on their honeymoon when they got married. So, mm-hmm. So I like that ties in, but I really like the little shot of her, like.
She's picking at the bullet hole?
Yeah, but like, I wasn't going to use that. See, she's almost like caressing the wall in a way that like, almost like it'll be okay. You know, like that's, I don't know. Like she's sort of like mothering it in a way. I don't know. It's weird.
I didn't catch that because as she's like kind of going through the bullet, I think she was trying to get it out. But I think as she was doing it, like pieces of the wall were falling away from it. So I don't know that I got that.
Yeah. Well, what do I know? I watched this like 2 weeks ago. So
yeah, I'm here to correct you. Let me talk about the other kids.
Yeah. I did pull up the IMDb. So like Chris Owen, obviously, you know, a lot of people know him from American Pie. He plays Quentin.
Yeah.
William Lee Scott plays Roy and Chad Lindbergh plays Odell. Chad Lindbergh, a lot of people would know from the very first Fast and the Furious movie. He's one of Vin Diesel's crew in that film. The other guy, William Lee Scott, I know he's been in a bunch of other stuff, but I don't recall offhand what that is. So, but they're pretty good. You know, obviously, you know, each one of them has a very distinct personality. You know, in movies, you kind of do that. Whereas in like in real life, a lot of people are a lot more similar.
Yeah. Especially friends.
Yeah.
I don't know. Did they ever talk about it? Like Odell, he's got like a limp.
I don't recall if they actually explain why in the movie. I just assumed that he was, you know, that he had a bum leg.
Yeah.
I
don't know. I mean, one of the things I noticed about the film is that he's got a pretty great voice, and his delivery I thought was pretty cool compared to the other kids.
Yeah.
Like definitely Chris Owen's Quentin, he kind of has that stereotypical kind of like nerd thing. So I mean, that's one of the things that kind of plays on stereotypes a little bit. But you know, I guess when you see like his upbringing, I never thought that was like such a big deal that he lived on like outskirts or what have you. Can you explain why like he was afraid to have people know where he lived? I never really understood that. Is it because he lived like?
He didn't live in Colwood. He lived, you know, like in the poor part of like the next town.
Yeah. But so there was like the one thing maybe I could kind of think about is that like I guess when Jake Gyllenhaal gets off the bus to see him, looks like he's addressed by like a prostitute. So is it because he lives in like that area?
Maybe? Yeah, I think so. But I think it's also like when we get that shot of them opening his bedroom door where he's like studying. There's two other kids sleeping next to him. So like he's really in like a cramped quarters. So I think it's just that he's poorer than the rest of them.
Okay. But I guess so.
I do like that they kind of pepper in a bunch of those like conflicts between the boys. It's not just them against the town or anything like that. You know, like it takes a little bit for Homer to convince these guys. You know, once they get in trouble the first time,
they definitely have the feeling, you know, they're definitely of like Homer's father's opinion that this is their destiny.
Yeah, absolutely. But you know, like one of the both of their fathers are dead, right? For Odell and Roy. Roy has a stepdad that beats him, but Odell's father's the one that got decapitated by the slate.
Yeah.
And that's a point where they actually have like a little bit of a fist fight, you know. When Odell gets upset because Homer brings it up and they go at it a little bit. So I like that, you know, these guys are sort of like battle tested a little bit with each other.
Yeah, they know. I mean, in that moment, Homer wants to hurt him. So he mentions something that he knows like it's typically off limits because he knows what buttons to push.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the same scene where the guy with the Corvette comes in, right?
Uh-huh. Well, I mean, they have a, you can tell they have a camaraderie just on like how to interact with each other. But when you see moments like that, like you mentioned, when they're in conflict with each other, you said battle tested. You definitely kind of see like more elements of like their real friendships.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's one of those friendships that can weather, you know, the arguments and things like that. But yeah, like that's the scene where like they're standing around and I think Roy is got like a 22 rifle and he's like shooting out the headlights of his own car, right?
Yeah.
And so a guy with like a brand new like 57 Corvette rides up. And then Homer has that line after they give them directions, you know, that, you know, you guys want to be coal miners for the rest of your life. So I think that, you know, part of that is, I don't think that represents a financial gain for Homer. I just think it represents a better life.
Yeah.
So I don't think he wants to become a rocket scientist for the money. I think he just feels he needs to get out of Coalwood, see the world, and do something better, different. Yeah. You know,
it's basically Beauty and the Beast.
You know what I thought was funny? In the early part of the movie, when Homer like has that like proclamation to his family where he's like, "I'm gonna build a rocket," like that reminds me of like that moment in A Christmas Story where Ralphie's like, "Flick saw some grizzly bears by Pulaski's candy store," and the whole family kind of looks at him like he's got three heads.
His brother's kind of a dick, you know.
Yeah, I think the brother character is obviously he's very underdeveloped, but at the same time, they do just enough to make it okay. And he is a little bit of a dick, but at the same time, like,
just a big brother.
Yeah, but you know, like when his father gets hurt, the first person to say "I'll go down in the mine" is the big brother. And, you know, and then Homer's like, "No, you have a future. You are going to school for football, you know, on a scholarship. You're going to get out of here. I'll go down to the mine." So, and that sacrifice, you know, him allowing Jim to continue doing what he's doing, I think changes their relationship. And I think the entire rest of the movie, you never see any conflict between them. Even the moment when Jim brings Dorothy to, like, the party or the bar or wherever they are.
That's before that, though.
Is it?
Right? Because that happens right after they get caught or blamed.
Oh, you're right. You're right. Yeah. Cause it's actually the same night, though, right? Because he goes outside after his brother's dating Dorothy, and that's when the other girl...
Valentine
shows up, and they end up going and parking underneath the railroad bridge. Mm-hmm. And that's when the guys show up and tell him that there's been an accident. Okay. You're right. But in any case, like I feel like that there's a deeper respect between the brothers after that point in the movie.
Sure.
Yeah. You know,
I think when you see him do stuff, it's never like malicious in a way. It's like there's a lot of it's teasing. Like the one scene, I guess, when he's being recruited for college football.
Yeah, on Homer's birthday.
Yeah. And like he tells this complete stranger in their home that, you know, his brother's like, I can't remember what the exact line is, but he says something with like a big grin, you know, how, you know, I guess just pushes his buttons in a way only like a relative knows how to.
Yeah. I think it's a good, you know, older brother, younger brother dynamic. Like even in the beginning of the movie, like we're introduced to Homer, at football tryouts.
Yeah.
And the first thing his brother says is, "Take it easy on my kid brother.
Make him look good."
Yeah. So there's a little bit, you know, there's definitely that, you know, that give and take, you know, push and pull with them. But it seems like a normal, healthy relationship, though.
Yeah. Who did the score for this film?
The music was by a guy named Mark Isham. And he's had, you know, a good career, you know, doing movies. He did stuff like Blade, The Mist, Invincible, Men of Honor, Varsity Blues, The Majestic, For Baltimore natives, he did the score for Home for the Holidays.
Yeah.
So he's got, you know, he's
I thought the score was pretty good.
He's got a pretty good resume. Yeah, the score's good.
Yeah, I think you really hear when you hear like the main theme during, I guess the last scenes of the film when they're shooting off their final rocket. I think that's a pretty good moving moment.
Yeah, especially since you get that, you know, John kind of putting like his arm around him for the first time, and
yeah, all around the town.
Yep. Oh, I do like when Homer comes to John and says, "We're shooting our last rocket off at 5 o'clock." John gets in the elevator, and the elevator closes, and you've got like the grating in front of him as he's going down in the mine, so that you got that whole visual motif of, you know, he's trapped in that life, whereas Homer is escaping it.
Homer's walking away from it. Right. He shows his award, and
yeah. So that's there. You go. There's another nice little visual thing.
Yeah, like his son. He's like he might be losing his son too. You know, if he doesn't take that leap.
Right, but he does make that choice, so which is great. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's so heartwarming. It's a father son story.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, but yeah, I it's good. It's a really solid movie. I recommended this at Suncoast countless times.
Yeah,
you know,
me too.
When people would come in and be like, you know, I need a film for the entire family, but I don't want a kids movie. Like, this was one of my go-tos. They're like,
sure.
Everybody in your family can enjoy this. It's a heartwarming story. It should keep, you know, kids and adults interested in it. It's got good performances. It's very solid. So yeah. So if you haven't seen it and you listen to this podcast, man, watch it. What are you waiting for?
What did you watch it on?
I have an old Universal DVD. I have not upgraded to a Blu-ray.
Sure. Yeah. That's what I did too.
It's funny because, when you put the DVD in, it's one of those DVDs where it has both full screen and widescreen on it.
Ew.
And you have to choose. So, like, I think the last time we put it in, I hit play, and then I walked away expecting it to, like, start. And then a minute later, I look at the TV, and nothing's happening because it's on that screen where it says, do you want widescreen or full screen?
Well, why would I pay for all of my TV and watch half of it? We're going to throw a widescreen, full screen joke every time.
Every time. Cool. What are we doing next?
I guess I was thinking about doing an Asian film.
Okay.
For our next one. And it's a film I just discovered last year, but I can't wait to rewatch it. Our Little Sister, which I talked at length a bit in a previous episode.
Okay.
If you're cool with that. It's put out by Sony, so I'm pretty sure you can find it pretty much anywhere, even video streaming. It's on DVD. I have a Korean Blu-ray. So there's no Japanese Blu-ray that has English subtitles, so the Korean one is what I'm going with. But yeah, Sony releases it internationally, so you should be pretty easy to find a copy of it.
Okay, Our Little Sister. There you go, folks. Watch that and get ready for episode 27.
All right. Any final thoughts?
I did my wrap-up.
Yeah. I guess I'm good, too.
Well, if you have anything to add, please do. This was your pick. And, it, you know, look at that. We went over an hour, so I was wrong. We filled an hour.
Dead wrong. Well, I mean, I guess I don't personally have anything else to say. I thought this was a good discussion. Whenever we tend to agree generally with a lot of movies, but I think the way you and I view this film is actually pretty close to each other, so it's nice, but like you have a slight different interpretations, but it was very interesting to talk about this film that I know that I've known for a long time that you loved, but we never ever really had a chance to discuss it. So thank you, CJ.
Thank you, Cesar. And where can people find you on the internet?
Of course you can find me at filmsmash.com, as well as on Twitter at JuniorBeho.
And you can find me at Setting the Frame on Twitter. That's pretty much it. Or on our Facebook page, of course.
You got to increase your social media footprint.
I'm on Vero, but nobody seems to be on Vero these days.
I don't even even know what that is.
That's it's a new social media thing. Like they gave away a free, like a million free memberships last year or whatever. So I signed up for it. I'll tell you who's on Vero a lot is Zack Snyder.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, he posts like a ton of behind the scenes footage and things like that, like footage and pictures and.
Who owns Vero?
It's a British company, I think. So I'm not recommending you join Vero, but if anybody's out there on Vero already, you know, whatever, find me.
Okay.
So we'll see you guys next time, and have a good one.
All right.
Thanks, Cesar.
Celluloid Jelly was recorded using Google Hangouts, mixed using Apple's GarageBand software, and hosted by Podbean. For any inquiries related to Celluloid Jelly, please email settingtheframe@gmail.com.